This is Craig Brown, and welcome to Passages. Passages is a space to explore Bible passages used for preaching, reflection, and prayer. My hope is that Passages will shine a unique light on text used for preaching at the First Free Methodist Church of Seattle, or for anyone looking to dive deeper into the Bible. Today's passage is taken from the Gospel of Mark, the 11th chapter, beginning at the first verse. It's the basis for the sermon at First Free Methodist Church on March 24, 2024. It happens to be Palm Sunday. Well, let's start by hearing the reading from the New American Standard Bible, its 2020 revision of Mark chapter 11. Beginning at verse 1, it says, "And they approached Jerusalem at Bethphage and Bethany near the Mount of Olives. He sent two of his disciples and said to them, 'Go into the village opposite you, and immediately as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, on which no one has ever sat. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone says to you, "Why are you doing this?" say, "The Lord has need of it," and immediately he will send it back here." They went away and found the colt tied at the door, outside in the street, and they untied it. And some of the bystanders were saying to them, What are you doing untying the colt?" And they told them just as Jesus had said, and they gave them permission. They brought the colt to Jesus, put their cloaks on it, and sat on it, and he sat on it. And many people spread their cloaks on the road, and others spread leafy branches which they had cut from the fields. And those who went in front and those who followed were shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest." And Jesus entered Jerusalem and came into the temple area. And after looking around at everything, he left for Bethany with the 12, since it was already late. This is, of course, a well-known reading within the life of the Christian year. It is from Palm Sunday, the Sunday that begins Holy Week, that will culminate ultimately in the Last Supper Jesus will share with his disciples on Thursday night, his betrayal in the garden overnight Thursday into Friday, and his early morning trial leading to his crucifixion by 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday. And then ultimately, the new week will begin on Easter Sunday with Jesus' victorious resurrection from the dead. So these events are just 8 days away from what Easter Sunday will be. As we read verses 1 through 6, we are preparing for Jesus' entry into the city of Jerusalem. Now, Jesus arrives near Jerusalem either on the same day as his steep ascent from Jericho, or perhaps the next day. Now, Jericho is down in the Jordan River Valley just north of the Dead Sea, and to come from Jericho up to Jerusalem is to ascend 5,000 feet in elevation. Now, as Jesus comes up from Jericho, he is in Bethany, and we know from the Gospel of John that Bethany is the home of Lazarus, whom he has just raised from the dead. Now, this story, of course, is not in Mark's Gospel, but it's important to mark why Jesus has stopped in Bethany and perhaps who he might be staying with while he's there. For all we know, Jesus either got there that morning, the night before, or maybe he's been there for some time. But suffice to say, he's ascended almost all the way to Jerusalem by being at Bethany. Mark's timing, as he describes the story in his gospel, is much, much more economical. If you were to read Mark's gospel from beginning to end, all 16 chapters of it, Mark almost makes it sound like everything that happened in the life of Jesus happened in a matter of just a few weeks or even days. And this was for the benefit of Mark's dominantly Roman audience that he was writing to. They were used to reading stories that didn't have long orations in them, but rather had kind of quick moving action. It's one of the reasons when you read Mark's gospel, you'll see the word immediately quite often in it. It almost makes it sound like Jesus went from one event to another immediately after the other. Now, when Jesus arrives at Bethany, he's on the back side of the hill called the Mount of Olives. So in other words, if you were in Bethany and then you kept going up the hill, eventually you would summit at the top of what's called the Mount of Olives, and you would be overlooking the city of Jerusalem. And so Jesus in this journey will eventually summit that hill. Before he does, though, he sends two of his disciples, and they're not named in Mark's gospel, and off they go to find a colt for him. He gives them specific instructions to go to the town next to where they're staying. So the town next to Bethany is Bethphage, and that's the next town up the hill before you would summit the Mount of Olives. Bethany was slightly off the main road, but Bethphage was exactly on the road. And so they go there, and they find the animal that Jesus told them they would find. Now, we're not sure that the disciples' request of the colt was an act of clairvoyance, or if Jesus maybe had already arranged it. The story really doesn't tell us. So the way it reads in Mark's, it almost Mark's gospel, it looks like the two disciples went up to Bethphage and randomly started taking a colt that wasn't theirs, and then they were approached by bystanders as they were doing so. More likely than not, so that this story doesn't represent a form of theft, this is probably likely that Jesus has made arrangements for the animal already and that the disciples are simply going to pick it up when they get there. Now, Jesus doesn't tell them who they're supposed to specifically see, but only that they're to enter a village, which is Bethphage, and when they see the colt, they're to take it. And it's likely the foal of a donkey rather than a horse. So when we think of colt, don't think of horse, think of donkey. And it's an animal that's used to carry things, not wage war. And no one has set on this animal. Now, there's several meanings to that, but it was probably an animal, at least at this point, that was maybe used to carry cargo or materials, but hadn't yet carried any human being. This is important because it having not been ridden means that in some ways it's available for sacred or royal uses. Typically, rulers or kings would ride a horse that hadn't been ridden by anyone else. And so to find an animal that no one had set on means it's an appropriate ride for Jesus as he enters the city of Jerusalem. And what's interesting here is that if two armies, let's say, were in battle in the ancient world and the two commanders wanted to parley with each other, they would ride out into the battlefield at an appropriate pause, not riding a horse, but usually riding on a donkey. Riding on a donkey or a mule symbolized or represented to the opposing forces that the ruler or general was coming in peace to negotiate or to parley, not necessarily to deceive and to somehow murder the other commander. So Jesus's choice of animal here is important, and that they're simply told the disciples to bring it. And if people ask what they're doing, then Jesus says, tell them the Lord has need of it. Well, that raises a question here in Mark's gospel that's interesting for Bible study, but maybe not as exciting for a sermon, is who's the Lord here? We assume that when Jesus tells them the Lord has need of it, that Jesus is referring to himself somehow. He could potentially be referring to the owner of the horse. Lots of people were called Lord, especially those that had some sort of status or office. So it's not a title specifically reserved for Jesus only. So we're not quite sure who they're talking to here. It's a common question among scholars when they read this text, who is the Lord here and what is the word Lord or Kurios, what does it mean in Greek? Regardless, the two went, they found the colt on the street, just as Jesus had said, and they started taking the colt, and then there were some bystanders. Notice that's not the owner, it's just bystanders to say, hey, what are you guys doing? And they say, the Lord has need of it, and immediately he will send it back here. So don't worry about it. The animal's going to be returned. So the people that approached the disciples in Bethphage didn't know who they were, didn't know whose colt it was, simply knew that it probably wasn't theirs. They asked questions that Jesus said they might ask. So they responded to the bystanders exactly the way Jesus instructed them, and they went on their way. Now, this opens up a key passageway, minor as it is, but it is so still important in our lives. And the key passageway is this: God provides for every moment of need. God provides for every moment of need. Jesus' arrangements for the colt are for his entrance into the city of Jerusalem. And this entire passage, like the other passages that describe the triumphant ending entrance of Jesus are ripe with irony. Jesus has been telling his disciples throughout Mark's gospel since Mark chapter 8 that they are going to Jerusalem, and there, once he arrives, he's going to be killed, and 3 days later he'll rise from the dead. Now, the text doesn't tell us about the expectations of the disciples. It's focused, rather, on what Jesus needs for the task he's going to accomplish. The work of the disciples is to obey, while perhaps not fully understanding why this animal is needed. As followers of Jesus, we have to learn to live in this same sort of way, that we wait and are reliant on God's direction for us. We follow and while trusting Jesus with the outcome. So what that means is that we may not really know what we need in any given situation. Jesus knows what we need, so we need to hold on to him rather than what we think we need. As human beings, what we want is oftentimes more important than what we need. And what challenges us in the story, and I love the way the disciples are depicted here, they're given instructions by Jesus, they follow the instructions to the letter, and everything happens exactly the way it's supposed to happen. We need to trust each step with Jesus, not the next 10 steps or even the destination, but just the next step. Jesus is about to do something exceptional. So what we need to learn how to do in our lives is to trust him rather than wanting to know and trust the outcome that he is working toward. Mark's gospel now begins in verse 7 and turns us away from the preparation for Jesus' entry into the city to when he actually begins the process of moving toward Jerusalem. Now, Mark's version of this story is striking, and it differs from the story that is recorded in Matthew and Luke and even in the Gospel of John. Once Jesus gives his followers directions about securing the colt, I want you to take notice, he says nothing else in the entire story. From the time that colt arrives and Jesus mounts it, he doesn't say one thing in Mark's gospel all the way to the city of Jerusalem, in the city, and when he leaves. Jesus is silent in this story. And Mark is likely the first of the gospels to be written. So in other words, out of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Mark was probably written first, and many scholars believe that Matthew and Luke had a copy of John, of Mark sitting in front of them as they even wrote their own gospels. And Mark's focus is different. So as we mentioned a moment ago, Mark doesn't like capturing long speeches or teaching by Jesus. He's much more focused on the narrative, the story. Where is this going? What's happening? What are the events? And so as we read the story beginning at verse 7, we find that the colt is brought to Jesus and they place their garments on it for him. It functions as Jesus's saddle. And this was important to recognize that this had to do with Jesus's ride on this colt being a kingly one. The garments weren't just thrown on an animal because there was no saddle to be found. Sometimes garments or cloth blankets were laid in place of a saddle to recognize that the regent is coming, the king is coming. And so this isn't a animal of war. This is rather one coming in, so to say, comfort, if you will. And notice the difference between a colt and a horse. If you rode a horse, that meant you were coming in power and strength. If you were a military commander, it means you came conquering. If you rode a colt or a donkey, in this case, it signals again the coming in peace. Jesus ascends the Mount of Olives from the east, in other words, coming from Bethany, then Bethphage, and then he comes down the mountain on the colt. Now, entrances into the city of Jerusalem were nothing new. There has been many great entrances into the city of Jerusalem. Even in the more recent memory of the people of Judah, Alexander the Great in the 4th century entered the city of Jerusalem on the very same route, riding a horse. We know in history of at least 8 different entries into the city by leaders in the Second Temple era. So the first temple is the temple that Solomon built that was destroyed by the Babylonians. The Second Temple era is the temple that was constructed by Zerubbabel, and then eventually also to some degree Nehemiah. And that temple stood in place from roughly the late 500s all the way until this day, in which Herod had undertaken a massive remodeling of that temple during his reign at the very, very beginning of the first century. So it's this Second Temple era that's important for us to sit with just for a little bit, because when we read history going back 300 years, 200, even 100 years, there's a number of different Jewish and Gentile leaders that enter the city utilizing the very same route that Jesus is using, symbolically recognizing the entrance into the city by its east gate. Jesus's entry into the city, though, is unique in Mark. In the other Gospels, Matthew and Luke and John, it says the crowds came out to meet Jesus and welcome him. In Mark, only his followers of some unknown number, it was the 12 plus some others, accompany him in his entrance. So it's unusual, though, for a person to enter the city on an animal, because most did so on foot. So there's a way in which Jesus is drawing attention to him, like those who've entered the city before mounted on a horse, that he's trying to signify something in his entrance into the city. This is not a normal entrance into Jerusalem. He's making a clear statement about what he's doing, especially since he's entering through the east gate of the city. This east gate is the pathway through which the Messiah is prophesied to come into the city of Jerusalem. Matter of fact, if you go to Jerusalem today, the evidence of the city being controlled by Muslim empires, Ottoman empires, and others who were not of the Jewish faith, there's actually a cemetery built in front of the east gate, and it is walled off. In other words, there's stones that fill the east gate. And in some ways, it's designed to prevent a Jewish Messiah from entering the city. No Messiah would be able to walk through a graveyard. They'd be unclean as they came into the city. So there's, even today, you'll see these clear barriers to prevent any messianic figure from entering the city. That was not the case in Jesus's day. The gate was open. And so coming to that east gate signified something. Jesus is making a clear statement. People spread their cloaks on the road in front of him. Not only is he sitting on cloaks, but they spread them on the ground. This is an established sign of importance that the person who rode on the back of that steed or was walking and had cloaks placed on the garment before him were being welcomed as a person of importance. It's similar to another story we know in the Bible that's recorded in the Chronicles of King Jehu, who entered the city of Jerusalem with cloaks spread out on the ground before him. Even some of the language that's cited here in their acclamation, where they say, "Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David," is a line of celebration from when Solomon entered the city of Jerusalem, Solomon, the son of King David. Now, other people spread leafy branches or cut grass on the ground. We call this event Palm Sunday often, but let's keep in mind, out of the 4 Gospels, only John tells us that there were palm branches involved. In all the other Gospel accounts, it's leafy branches or cloaks or things like that that Jesus walks, has his colt walk on as he enters the city. The text tells us in Mark there was a group in front of him, and there was a group behind him, and they were shouting some things out. And what they were shouting was, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." This is lifted from Psalm 118, which is a royal psalm of ascension. It was a psalm that was sung or prayed as the entrance into the city of Jerusalem by the kings. The word Hosanna, just for trivia's sake, means literally "save us now" is what Hosanna means, "save us now." So it's interesting that they shout Hosanna. So whether it's a directly at or toward Jesus, or it's directly at or toward God because of what Jesus is doing, the people are crying out for God to save us in this moment as they shout with Jesus entering the city. And then where they say, blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Again, this points to the reign of Solomon. This is a similar phrase used to welcome his entrance into the city. Now, all of this language that's being used here out of Psalm 118 for Solomon, this is all messianic language. This is all language that was commonly thought about and pondered upon by Jewish scholars and Jewish people as referencing their Messiah. But keep in mind, this is all out in the open now. Throughout Mark's gospel, Jesus has done miracles and teachings and all sorts of things, but in almost every episode, he's told people to keep it a secret, to not tell anyone. And now, that is not the case. There is no secrecy. Jesus is clearly being welcomed by the crowd accompanying him as the Messiah. It is out in the open. But also keep in mind that Jesus says nothing in Mark's account of the story. So as the people shout their hosannas, as they lay their garments on the road in front of him, as Jesus rides toward the east gate, he fully embraces the acclaim they're giving him, the welcome they're offering him as the Messiah as he comes into the city of Jerusalem. So there's a humility about Mark's description of this episode that's different from the other gospel writers. The text in Mark doesn't mention any kind of crowd that's come out. It's just the followers of Jesus that are shouting and waving branches and throwing garments in the road. And so Mark's depiction of this entrance is very much subdued compared to the other gospel writers. Mark's version of this story is designed to draw attention to the very humility of Jesus, who embraces the role of Messiah but does not hold it in a way that people expected the Messiah would. He accepts their praise, but he doesn't encourage it either. He enters the city, and then he goes to the temple court, the text tells us. He would have normally expected to receive some sort of greeting or blessing by the priests once he entered the temple, but Mark tells us that there was no such greeting. So all Jesus could do would go into the city and look around at the temple, and he left. Now, the final chapters of Mark, beginning here at verse 11 all the way through chapter 11, chapter 15, focus on Jesus's interaction with the temple and its authorities. So in all of the narratives we'll read from here on out are about Jesus' encounter with people in the temple or people in the temple's encounter with him. So this really captures the final narrative of Mark's gospel as Jesus is in the city. The priests or the leaders are either listening to him or they're plotting against him. So with no greeting, with no acknowledgement of his presence by anyone, Jesus turns around. It's the end of the day. He's there with the 12, and he goes back to Bethany. Somewhat of an anticlimactic end to this story, but it's in keeping with the way Mark tells the story. It opens a final key passageway for us, and it's this: that the work of God often defies and exceeds expectations. You know, when I read this story, which, you know, we read every year in the life of the Christian year, I always wonder about what it's like for the people that are there. You know, the people participating in the procession or the people in Jerusalem who just happened to see Jesus come into the city. What did they expect in this moment? What did the disciples expect? I mean, did they still see Jesus as a king of the Jewish kingdom that has come to conquer the Romans? Were they expecting him to come into Jerusalem and wield supernatural heavenly power against corrupt authorities and Roman domination? I mean, is that what they had in their heart and in their mind? Is that what the people in the city of Jerusalem have? I wonder about what they thought or experienced in that moment. Palm Sunday is then a day about irony, that Jesus in this story is clearly laying claim to the title of Messiah by riding on a colt and saying nothing. That's the irony. He embraces the acclaim, he embraces the title, he embraces the role, but he does it in the most unorthodox sort of way. He is in many ways to us, like them, what we make him to be. In this sense, Jesus goes about his work in the week to come. He's going to preach and teach in the temple virtually every day until the religious leaders have had enough of him. And They then, those religious leaders and the people of Jerusalem, and we today are left with deciding about what to do with Jesus. Does he meet our expectations? Does he not? Does he exceed them? How do we feel about that on any given day? Do we think that Jesus has heard us, is with us, or sometimes not? Now, most expected Jesus, of course, to depose the Romans, but no one apparently thought that he would depose a foe greater than the Romans, that the thing he would depose is sin and death, and ironically, he would do so through his own death. Certainty about what God is calling us to do always has to be tempered with a little bit of truth. Remember the key passageway, the work of God often defies and exceeds expectations. God is at work towards something which we seldom can see or even understand. All the more reason to trust him. It's a far better thing for us to trust the one who holds all things than for us to try to hold all things ourselves. If you have comments or reflections, I invite you to visit my website, revcraig.com. Click on News in the upper right-hand corner, and in the drop-down menu, you'll see the word Podcasts. Then click on this week's episode. You're welcome to leave a comment. Also invite you to visit our church's website, ffmc.org, firstfreemethodistchurch.org, to learn more about Free Methodism and how you can connect with our community. For now, I bid you all grace. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.